Hello and welcome. You are watching Lockdown TV. This is the news and discussion program from unheard.com. Over the past few weeks, we have been bringing big thinkers and experts and people from around the world to better understand what on earth is going on with this pandemic and what the best response to it should be, and looking ahead to what sort of world we're going to inherit after it. I am delighted that today we are joined by Sikora. Can you see and hear us, Professor Sikora?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Very good. So you're a professor of medicine at the University of Buckingham. You were formerly the director of the World Health Organization Cancer Program. And you have become somewhat of a celebrity over the past few months by giving kind of reassuring and somewhat more positive news and commentary on the ongoing crisis. Let's dive straight in. There was a message you put on Twitter a few days ago that caught my eye, where you said that you thought there's a real chance the pandemic might burn out naturally. What did you mean by that?
If you look at the history of pandemics, from the Black Death through to the plague, through to more modern SARS and MERS that we've all experienced in our lifetime, they die out when people say they've died out. Of course, we're living with SARS and MERS, but we're not concerned about them. I feel the same thing will happen to the coronavirus. We will no longer be concerned. At the moment, we're consumed with it. The news is consumed with it. We're obsessed with body counts. Many of the people that have died, sadly, would have died anyway at exactly the same time. We're really quite taken in by the situation of the virus. And different countries have assumed different ways to police their people. Here, it's very British. It's a persuasive matter. In some countries, military police states, it's strictly enforced. And woe betide you if you break the isolation rules. So it is a fascinating way in which medicine, infection, the virus impinge on our freedoms as a society.
So there's the kind of, I guess, more social aspect of that. But on the medical side, what sort of evidence or how should we think about a virus dying out? I mean, in a sense, the policy is predicated on the presumption that if we stop with the social restrictions, it will come back and there'll be a big second spike and so on. Do you think that's a questionable assumption?
No, it's a valid assumption. We've heard a lot about the magic R0 number, which I last heard as a medical student 50 years ago. And now everybody can talk about, my kids talk about R0 to me. I mean, I've never seen anything like this. And there's no doubt that if the R0 goes up, the chances are the new infection rate will go up. But something's happened over just the last 2 weeks. The infection rate is going down, but the hospitalizations, certainly in the UK, have gone right down, and the deaths have gone right down. I mean, there's lots of little blips in it because of the way the data are counted. But there's no doubt things are getting better all over the world. Europe is opening up now. Austria, the first country to open up on the 14th of April, has had no second wave, no blip in increase, no problems epidemiologically with what's happened. The restaurants and cafes are beginning to open in Italy today, and hopefully there'll be no change. So, but we're all scared. And, you know, the political pressure on the school teachers, on governments to try and sort out should children go back is one of the big discussion points this week. My point of view is that we've got to end the pandemic and we've got to end the psychology of fear that we've built up for this pandemic. People have to be responsible for their own actions. And as we move forward, I think that's what we're going to see.
But do you think there's a chance that as we gradually release restrictions, we don't see a second spike and we can actually return not to some sort of new normal where we continue social distancing in perpetuity, but actually just the old normal?
I hope so. I really hope so. And when you look at second waves, WHO and in fact our NHS in Britain have predicted a second wave for September and then whatever we do. And then after that, we get what's called winter pressures, which is the code for old people flooding hospitals with chest infections. And it happens every winter since I've been a doctor. And there's no doubt that the combination of a second wave, a significant second wave, and winter pressures could completely flood the NHS again. It didn't get flooded in April when it was supposed to. It managed to cope really well. The Nightingale hospitals were left essentially empty. They opened the one in London just as a token to show it could be done. A few patients were treated there, but it certainly wasn't a necessary implementation. As we move forward, it's clear that if there's no rise in the cases as the R0 comes up to one, they may never come. And viruses change. It's as though the virus is getting bored. I mean, how can a virus get bored? It's the tiniest form of life. You could even question whether it's alive or not if you're a philosopher. But there's no doubt the problem we've got is fear of what could happen, fear to protect healthcare systems, fear that could actually kill more people. Because people, my specialty, cancer, are just not coming forward. The cancer patients have disappeared from April, and it looks as though they're still keeping away in May. We've got to get them back. It's not just the patient's fault, it's the system unable to do the diagnostic procedures to label them as having cancer. But we've got to get that moving.
So you're talking about cancer patients, you're an oncologist. You took part in a group that came up with an estimate of potential additional deaths or avoidable deaths that we might see through untreated cancer patients. That number was 50,000. Is that something you stand by now? Do you think it's grown or shrunk since you made that estimate?
Absolutely. That was predicated on a delay of 6 months. In other words, if we go on like this for 6 months, what we would see is upward stage migration. That means that a cancer that's stage one, that has a good outcome, would move to stage two or three by spreading to lymph nodes. It doesn't matter where the cancer is, breast, lung, colon, and prostate are the four common cancers. They'd all do the same. They'd spread. And as they spread, the treatment to get best results gets more complicated. It gets more expensive. It involves more chemotherapy, more radiotherapy than would be needed for an earlier stage cancer. So that migration of stage is a disaster. If you take stage one or two breast cancer, currently 95% of women with those two stages will survive 5 years and are essentially cured of their cancer. If it moves to stage three, the figure drops to only 25%, and that's with optimal care. Right. The other problem we've got is when the brakes are taken off the health service, we'll see a surge of cancer, we'll see a surge of heart disease, a surge of mental health problems. And we'll have to do some sort of triage and rationing to deal with people in an orderly way. And that's coming later on this summer, almost certainly.
So, I mean, if what seems to have happened, I don't know if you agree with this sort of narrative, but what seems to have happened is 10 or 12 weeks ago when these first models came and there was suddenly this big fear of a big, huge tsunami of incoming patients, the government kind of cleared out the hospitals quite hastily and didn't seem to make ongoing provision for other kinds of patients. Was that a mistake of kind of overreaction?
It's difficult. I mean, it wasn't an overreaction because we really hadn't got any idea what would happen. I mean, Italy was a disaster. If you remember the pictures that we saw in early April, late March, I mean, it would frighten any politician. And we don't want to repeat that. So clear the deck, stop operating, stop doing everything, stop diagnostic procedures, even cancer, try and cut back on existing cancer treatment, stop the footfall in hospitals, stop visitors from coming in, all these things. And remember, it's not only the NHS is going to be needed to treat corona patients, you've also got the problem that you're working under an umbrella of infection. So the more people you have visiting a hospital site, the more chance, the more cars you have in the car park, the more chance there's going to be problems. So doing everything possible to reduce that. Now's the time, of course, and maybe you could say we're too late. We should have done it a couple of weeks back. As we come out of lockdown, let's get the hospitals working again. The whole machinery, it doesn't matter whether it's private or public hospitals, let's get the machinery back up to speed.
So should we be doing sort of corona hospitals and non corona hospitals? Is that one option we should be looking at?
Or at least corona-free zones, CFZs as they're called, within the hospital. So cancer should be treated in a corona-free zone, and that's possible. You have a nice person at the door with a temperature meter and asking people about symptoms. And if there's any doubt, you just delay that patient. No need to isolate them if they've got no symptoms, but just delay their coming into the hospital. So we have these zones. Most cancer centres and most cardiology centres, because that's the other thing that's affected, heart disease, are operating in bits of the hospital that can be made corona-free. Testing is the key, both for staff and the patients, to make sure they are indeed free of the disease, and you maintain those areas, especially now we're coming out and the incidence of infection is dropping quite precipitously.
So you mentioned testing there. We've started to get some serology or antibody test results from around the world. There's been some from New York, which show anything upwards of 20 or 25% within New York City have antibodies. But then we have results from Spain, which show a very small percentage of people, maybe 4 or 5%, showing antibodies for COVID-19. What's your reading of that? Does that mean that only those percentages of people have had the disease, or are there, might it be a larger percentage or smaller, or what should we make of that?
I think they're rather immune mechanisms. We tested our own staff, about 200 people, and just like in Spain, the incidence of antibodies is less than 10%, which was surprising. I thought it'd be about 30%. We've done it twice at 4 weeks apart. And even last week, the testing showed the same thing, less than 10%. So it's not gone up, which implies there may be other mechanisms involved in the immune defense against COVID, the virus. And those could be cell factors that you don't measure by the antibodies. It also could be local antibodies in the mucosa of the nose and the back of the throat that kick the virus out before it actually mounts an antibody response that you test with the kit. So it's great to get information. What it means for an individual patient is not clear, but it's great. Phrases like immunoprivilege for people that are positive, that can all meet together without social distancing. A COVID elite, I saw in New York, the COVID elite go to bars and meet each other and so on, whereas if you're negative for antibody, you can't go. That's probably not going to happen. Also, how long does the immunity last? And all question marks.
But it's quite a significant idea, though, isn't it? Because at the moment, those tests are basically being treated as a sort of fact of what percentage of people have had the disease. So if we have results imminently coming from the UK, and there's sort of early rumours that it might be around 10% of the population, or between 6 and 7 million, who are showing antibodies. This is the new ongoing ONS and Oxford University study. When those results come out, you're saying that we shouldn't necessarily think that it's only that group that have had COVID.
Exactly, because of the other mechanisms. So young people, especially children, are behaving differently. It's not really affecting children. I know there's some problems and there have been childhood deaths, which is really sad. But on the whole, it doesn't affect children under 10. So really a puzzle. Why should that be? And one thing could be happening is the children have a very powerful immune system that just gobbles up the virus before it can actually mount an antibody response. So the children in certainly in the study in New York had a very low level of antibody production. The fundamental question is exactly what you asked. What percentage of the population are infected? Because if over 50% already are, then we have herd immunity and it'll just definitely peter out very quickly. We don't know where we are. The bottom end, you've got...
Do you have an estimate yourself? I mean, what's your estimate?
I think we're running about 25-30%. But it may be it's higher in the very group that's most susceptible. And so the susceptible group, the older and the more vulnerable, it has a much higher percentage. And if that's the case, that may be why we're seeing this downturn, complete downturn in the infection rate. I mean, I know social distancing is doing it, but something else has changed. It's not just the social distancing. We've been doing social distancing for, 6-7 weeks now. And so you'd expect a plateau, but no, it's a remarkable downturn. So I think my own feeling is the virus is getting tired, and whether it's changing, whether we're changing, but it's a combination of the virus getting tired and herd immunity coming, at least in subsets of the population, and those subsets stop the spread, basically.
This really chimes with an earlier interview we did with a guy called Michael Levitt, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, but he's a sort of numbers guy, and he was looking at the curves, at the epidemic curves across the world, and noticing that sort of regardless of what the intervention was, they were only exponential for a very short period, and then they started naturally kind of flattening off. Is what you're saying that there might be, across the world, there might be these other types of immunity that are actually slowing the pace regardless of the kind of government response?
Absolutely. And the problem with these other types of immune mechanisms, they don't leave a measurable footprint. So the antibody is like the footprint in the sand. We know the virus has visited our cancer centers because 10% of people do have the antibodies. They've been infected. Not everybody that gets infected actually has any symptoms at all. So about 50% do, 50% don't, which is a great puzzle. What's the selection process to give you symptoms? And going further, what's the selection process going on to actually make you seriously ill by giving you the lung damage that means you go short of oxygen, you end up in intensive care? So all these things are puzzles. But what we can see everywhere around the world, if you look at the peaks on Worldometer, they're all beginning to fall, more or less at the same time after the whole thing started, which is a real puzzle. There is no explanation for that, other than it's following the pandemics of the past, SARS and MERS and so on. Exactly the same happened there. There was some variation between countries and populations, but eventually everything came back to normal and we've lived with them. We're living with them now. I bet if we tested your antibody levels, not to the current coronavirus problem, but to the old coronavirus, you'd have antibodies to them, even though you may never know you've been infected with it.
So isn't there a danger then? There's so much talk of the R value, as you said, your grandchildren or your nieces and nephews know about it. Is there not a danger if we focus so much on this R number, which is hard to necessarily know for sure, we might be frightened of small upticks that actually might be quite harmless, and we could be prolonging this period of sort of anxiety beyond what is necessary?
Absolutely. And if we look at other countries, I mean, that's the best message, to look at what's happened in Austria, Czech Republic, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, which has always been unusual in the handling of the crisis, and start looking not just at the R0 number, but the total results of it. And the fact that Sweden's end result is not going to be different to ours. I mean, no lockdown versus lockdown. Having said that, there are all sorts of nuances. So the Swedes, the Scandinavian, on the whole, do what they're told. They're socially malleable and they're rigid about it. And they don't need to be policed. Maybe Americans do need to be, and maybe in France they do need to be. But I think persuasion, what we've done here, is a great compromise, I think, in social persuasion. Mm. It's left a lot of people too scared. And I think the elderly have been particularly targeted just for being old and being told to lock themselves up for 12 weeks. And that's unrealistic.
So, if we've been sort of overly pessimistic, I mean, you mentioned Sweden and they seem to be coming out with a similar kind of end result. Once you factor in these potential deaths from, as it were, the lockdown or from closure of hospitals and so on, at some point the intervening measures will be doing more damage than they're helping. Do you think we've passed that point?
I think we have, and I think the psychological damage is really profound. It's making people depressed. It's making them, obviously, the whole employment of people. Jobs are important, not just to earn money, but for self-esteem. And we've taken that away from a lot of people. The whole hospitality industry has collapsed everywhere. Hotels are still shut. Restaurants, obviously, and bars are shut. It's got to get back somehow. And I'm not suggesting we should suddenly say from the 1st of June everything opens up completely normally, but I think we can begin to get back. We can have social distancing. The whole social distancing evidence it doesn't say 2 meters is necessary, the optional. 1 meter is probably enough as long as people are responsible, don't come in with a fever and a cough, and not only that, adhere to the 1 meter rigidly. That's the WHO recommendation. The 2 meters is just a cautious approach to it. 2 meters is difficult to achieve in a restaurant. Maybe in a fancy restaurant it isn't. Maybe if you go to the top end you can do it and still make money. But I suspect most restaurants would struggle.
You'd like to see us get quite quickly to a sort of Swedish style, it's basically more relaxed version of the social distancing.
I think the evidence is not there, but either way, the government's been interested in their stance, sticking to the 2 meters. But of course, 2 meters is impossible on a commuter train, whether it's in London or Manchester. You just can't do it if the train's got reasonable numbers of people on it. So it's allowed it. And it's essentially broken its own rules on social distancing to allow the central line and run through central London in the rush hour. And it's the lower end of people, lower end financially of people that are using that. It's not the fat cats in the city that are going into it. They're all sitting at home in their mansions and so on. So there's a lot of social unfairness. You're expecting the cleaners, the janitors to still go into the city blocks, whereas you've kept your high value staff right away and safe. Mm-hmm. And so public transport is probably the place where you're most likely to. And yet we haven't seen a spike. And that is really quite amazing. Just in the last week, it's too short to know, but the trains have got busier, the trains have got more frequent, more crowded. And yet, hopefully by next week there'll be no spike. There wasn't in Austria, so why should there be here? I'm pretty good about the whole thing. In fact, I've been on the train myself a couple of times, albeit the carriage was mine, the whole carriage.
So if we don't see that spike, should we just carry on heading in the direction of back to normal then? At some point we then say no social distancing. If there's no spike...
Absolutely. That's the next thing. Can we get down to a meter, the WHO recommendation from the beginning? If we can do that, the next step is, just back to normal. People will be too frightened. I think we've got used to this concept, not shaking hands and all the rest of it, and that's probably good. We've got to continue with that. But there's got to come a time when the pandemic is over. The pessimists can say it won't be until the middle of next year, and the optimists can say it's going to be in the summer this year. I err on the summer this year. I'd prefer it to be that. But there is no evidence either way, except looking at past pandemics. And the biggest thing we have to conquer in society is fear. And that's where we've got to. And then the politics, the blame game that's inevitable all around the world for politicians, for the WHO, for the left against the right, the unions against the employers, all this sort of thing is going to be everywhere. And it's part of natural society in a democracy. So we've just got to ride with that and keep counting the number of new patients, the number of infections, and making sure the health services, whether it's in Britain or our NHS or in other countries, are sustainable for the level of illness that the virus is causing, without letting cancer patients, heart disease patients be thrown to the bus, essentially.
So looking back, how can we know whether all of these big interventions and lockdowns and clearing out hospitals and all of that was worth it? Or not?
We don't. Protect the NHS was a great slogan because that made people think twice about actually using NHS services. About they were doing it for other people, and it's very British, and it worked. Banging the spoons for the NHS, the same. You're doing something to support a structure. The difficulty is it really necessary to protect the NHS? It didn't need its protection. It did it very well. What we need now to do is not protect the NHS, but get the NHS back again, functional. And that is the biggest challenge at a time of fear. How do we get out of here now? The only way is to move slowly and surely. Get the schools back, get the nurseries open. Again, when you look at that, the unfairness of the schools is that the people that are suffering most are the people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. The kids from poor homes don't have computers. They don't have parents that can necessarily help them, as well as the middle class kids that have everything they want at home. And parents who, with lockdown, have been giving them personal tuition.
Would you like to see more schools opening sooner? Do you think that would be a safe approach?
I think opening schools is absolutely vital to get back a sense of normality. It's a pain with traffic jams, there's meeting and greeting issues at the doors of schools, but we've got to get over that. We've got to get schools back sometime. I don't see the point in waiting to September. We may as well do it in June and just move on. Again, monitoring what's going on. Children are not the transmitters of this virus on the whole.
So you think that the teachers' concerns and parents' concerns about bringing kids back to school are misguided and actually
achieved? The concerns are real and not misguided, but I think we just have to try it and see. Some people said, well, that's an irresponsible attitude. But the evidence everywhere is that opening primary schools first and nurseries that go with them seems that the first thing you do, because the evidence that young children spread this is almost zero. Secondary schools, you just have to wait to see what happens in the primary schools. Austria opened its primary schools way back after Easter, and there's been no increase in the families where the children come from, and that's the way to look at it. The danger of having schools working is that the teachers get it and the parents of other children transmit it to each other parent rather than the children getting it. The other thing that's clear is schools have been open in London and everywhere for key workers' children. And so the children have carried on and there's been no increase in infection amongst the teachers. So when do we start? Why wait? That's my argument.
So you'd like to see other years and more junior schools and more pupils coming in already in June, potentially.
Exactly. And, you know, one can extend the key worker concept that do it that way.
Masks, got to ask you, do you think we should all be wearing them? Should we be forced to wear them? Should it be voluntary? What's your view on masks?
I think it's a great British fudge. I like it, the way it's been handled. Basically, it's yes and no. You can choose yourself. The evidence on masks is just not there. Either way. And so the WHO recommend masks should be worn if you have a cough. But if you have a cough, you shouldn't be going out into a public place. So the mask is not for your protection. It's to protect you giving the virus to someone else by coughing and spluttering and getting that little droplets coming out. So it's a difficult one.
So masks, what about when you see people wearing masks walking down the street, or you sometimes see people wearing masks alone in their cars driving around? Do you think that's pointless?
I think it's probably pointless. The only situation I would say, the Uber drivers, the taxi drivers, where you've got different people coming in that back seat, no screen, probably I'd feel more comfortable wearing a mask if I had that job. I don't wear one myself on public transport, but then I think it's an individual decision. If some people feel comfortable, others wear a sort of cowboy style mask, that looks good too. It's all the same thing. It's keeping droplets out of your direct contact. And that's how the virus spreads. And obviously not touching things you don't need to touch.
Just to look at the kind of big picture then, as we sum up then, Professor Segura, I mean, you've had a long career in medicine, been involved in the World Health Organization. Why do you think it is that the response to this outbreak has been so different from previous pandemics? We had swine flu ended up killing, by according to official figures, between 500,000 and 600,000 people, but there was no shutdowns, no massive sort of focus on it in the same way. What do you think has happened in this instance?
I think it's fear. Society is afraid. It's been scared totally by governments at the beginning of it, not just the British government, all across the board. You know, when it first came out at the end of January, I really thought it would blow away. I was telling my grandchildren, don't worry, kids, it's all going to be gone within a couple of weeks. They'll never close Heathrow. They'll never do all the things that have happened. And they did happen. And I think it was driven by fear. You know, people do die, and every year in Britain, 620,000 people die, and that's the death rate. The death rate has been higher than normal the last 2 months, but it is returning now to the normality. And a lot of the people that die from COVID would have died anyway, sadly, in that period. So obviously, the images of hospitals, intensive care units, both here and abroad, have been portrayed right around the world, and they scare people. And the whole concept of drowning because of lung edema seems frightening. So it's I can see where the fear comes from. What we've got to do now to get out of here is somehow get rid of that fear and allow people to work and take part in a society where you accept death at one end and it's just part of life, as it was a year ago. We weren't frightened then, but we are frightened now. We're worried to go out. We're worried certainly to meet other people in case we get COVID. And we've got to get rid of that fear now.
Do you think when we look back at this in the history books in decades to come, it will be more the virus or more the associated fear that will have caused more damage?
The fear is going to cause the damage, not the virus. The virus will go, like all these viruses. It'll disappear. Some people say it just fades away. It doesn't even burn out. There's no sort of catastrophic ending for it. It's not like a war in which you suddenly corner the virus and blow it out. It's just going to fade away, as though it's got bored with this whole advance on society. But society is scarred all over the world. And you know, we'll see it go through political tensions. There'll be reports, reviews, blame culture here. You know, one of the common questions I get asked is, do you agree with government policy? Well, you know, at the time when they had the data, they couldn't see what the future held. And it's so easy retrospectively to say they shouldn't have done this or they should have done something different. And it's you can score political brownie points, but it's meaningless in reality. What we've got to do is get back to normality just as soon as possible, right across the board.
Professor Carol Sikora, thank you so much for that. We will we are going to try to fight the fear as well as fighting the virus. It's a great message. Thank you. You have been watching Lockdown TV. That was Professor Carol Sikora of the University of Buckingham. And we will be back tomorrow. Thanks for watching.